"Don't turn on the light." These were the last words Osama bin Laden would ever utter. There was no moon that night. There were strange sounds of explosions, and bin Laden and his youngest wife were effectively trapped in the third-floor bedroom of his fortress-like compound. As the SEALs climbed the stairs, bin Laden opened the metal gate that blocked access to his room, a gate that could only be opened from the inside, and poked his head out to see what the commotion was. It was a fatal error. He would die with a double tap of shots to the chest and his left eye. It was May 1st, 2011. In Manhunt, the 10-year search for bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad, CNN national security analyst Peter Bergen, America's foremost writer on counterterrorism, offers an account of how bin Laden was brought to justice. Bergen was the only outsider to tour the compound before it was destroyed by the Pakistani military. He's also one of only two journalists given access by the White House to the treasure trove of materials collected there. We welcome Peter Bergen to the roundtable. Peter, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, thank you. And Abbottabad is a difficult one to pronounce.
You know, I've been having problems with it all morning. I practiced, but I knew I was going to screw up. It was performance anxiety, and I failed the test. So I thank you very much for your for your understanding. This book is amazing. It really is. And obviously, having spoken to you a few times over the last 10 or 11 years on the subject of bin Laden, it's fascinating to have some conclusion to this. And really, I would assume that this is kind of the a grand finale, if you will, for you as putting all of the knowledge that you had about this man and being able to end the story, at least of his life, certainly not his legacy, but at least of his life.
Yeah, I mean, I've been working on this for 15 years, and this is my fourth book on the subject, and one of the reasons I was able to write it and report it and research it and publish it all in the space of a year is because I'm very familiar with kind of some of the background about him, about Al-Qaeda, U.S. military operations and the like. You know, in the past, it's taken me a lot longer than a year to write a book, but this one came pretty quickly, and I also had a pretty strong incentive for my publisher to get this done on time.
And on time being the 1 year anniversary. And
right.
But I assume it does take time to sort of let it soak in and realize what happened and give us the context, but also let the dust settle a little bit.
Well, you know, I mean, the story happened really in two places predominantly. It happened in Washington, at the White House, at the CIA, at the Department of Defense. It happened in Pakistan at the compound. And so those were the two places I, you know, spent most of my time and effort researching. I made three trips to Pakistan. As you mentioned in the introduction, I was the only outsider to be given access to the compound before it was demolished by the Pakistani military. And, you know, I'd spent enough time talking to people about what happened that night, both in Pakistan and the United States, to have a pretty good sense of kind of what the compound was like. But to go and see it, and, you know, it helped really, you know, make the whole, my narrative of it much more authentic, to be in the bedroom where bin Laden was shot and killed, to see how low the ceiling was, to see the blood stains that still marked the ceiling where the U.S. Navy SEAL shot that ripped through his left eye, you know, exited his head, and splattered blood on the ceiling, to see, you know, the Just for Men hair dye that he was using, which was on a shelf in his bedroom. You know, he was dyeing his hair and beard as he was in his mid-50s, and vanity, as it happens with so many people, had taken over, you know, his the way he wanted to look. The small little toilet where he would do his business, you know, the size of a small closet, basically a little hole in the floor where he would do his business, not the sort of image you usually associate with the world's most wanted man, the tiny little kitchen that he and his Yemeni wife would use, and the study in which he would tap out these long memos to members of Al-Qaeda, micromanaging them, telling them to attack the United States, warning them of how much you know, damage the American drone program was doing to Al-Qaeda. You know, all that, to see it firsthand is different than if you don't experience it directly.
What drew him to Abbottabad? What was it about that place and about that compound that brought him there for so long?
Well, you know, I start the book with the sentence, it was a perfect hiding place. I mean, and why was it perfect? Well, it's like, it's a small city in Pakistan, which is, you know, a retirement community. It has, you know, one of the best golf courses in Pakistan. It's not like all the other crowded, you know, heaving cities in Pakistan, which are full of people and very loud. It's got more of a country club vibe. It's got it's high up, relatively high up in the hills, so the weather is a bit better than, and it attracts, as a result, it attracts retired civil servants, retired Pakistani military officers, and you know, Bin Laden chose it for his retirement, and it's not far from the capital, Islamabad, of Pakistan. It's far enough away from the drones strikes in the Pakistani tribal regions that he wouldn't be impacted by those, but yet not so far that he couldn't communicate with his followers, many of whom are in that area. You know, it's just one of the last places in Pakistan you think that he was living, and it also has effective communications, you know, good road network to take you to the various. He had a courier who would be, you know, getting on the road to communicate with his followers, giving them computer disks, and it was, you know, a perfect place to disappear.
One of the things that struck me, and as you were saying, without being there, you don't have an idea of the story, but one of the things that struck me is he was a big guy. I'm 6'5", so I just, this kind of resonated with me, that the ceilings were only like 7 feet tall, and it was all very cramped for him.
Yeah, the whole place was cramped. I mean, there were 24 people living in this compound. Now, it's a big house. It had a one-story annex where the courier that was protecting him and his four kids and his wife lived. And then there was the main house in which Bin Laden lived with his 12 kids and grandchildren, his three wives, the courier's brother, his wife, and their kids. And even though it's a substantial house, you know, it's a lot of people crammed in. They were living, their beds were basically kind of pieces of plywood hammered together. Each wife had her own separate little kitchen, separate little bathroom. But, you know, these are all tiny little spaces. There was one room in which the sole TV in the house would be watched by Bin Laden and other members of the family. So, you know, on the one hand, it was cramped and confining. It was a prison of his own making. He, you know, made sure that on the floor he was on, there were very few windows, which was great in terms of people not being able to detect him. But it was not very good for him on the night of the raid because he couldn't see what was going on. So he was sort of a prisoner in a prison of his own making. On the other hand, you know, he was able to read, he was able to write, he was able to communicate with his followers, he had his three wives, he had his kids. You know, it wasn't such a bad life.
When you consider the other people in the compound, he would hide even from some of those people, you write.
Yeah, which is kind of amazing. There was one of the courier's wives had been instructed by her husband, you know, there is a stranger on this compound. You must never ask me who he is. You must never talk to him or talk about him. And she only clapped eyes on him once in the several years that she was living there and that Bin Laden was living there, because he was really confining himself to two floors of the main house. He would go out into the grounds of the compound very, very occasionally, relatively infrequently, to take a quick walk. The CIA was able to detect that somebody was taking a walk. They nicknamed him the Pacer, but they could never get a picture of him. They could just measure his shadow. And Leon Panetta, the director of the CIA, was extremely frustrated about all this and was trying to get, you know, like more definitive intelligence. He asked the National Geospatial Imagery Agency, which basically interprets a lot of satellite imagery, and asked them, how tall is this guy? And they came back with something like, well, he's somewhere between 5'4" and 6'6". So that wasn't much of a clue in terms of Bin Laden's height. So, you know, the evidence for Bin Laden being there was very circumstantial. There was no picture, there was no Polaroid moment when somebody got a shot or looked or was able to see Bin Laden at, you know, in this compound.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you were there to see the stuff that came out of the compound, the stuff that was taken out, this treasure trove, if you will. And you write in the book that what struck James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, were the effects of years of self-imposed isolation on Bin Laden. Clapper found Bin Laden's musings about mass casualty attacks on the American transportation system or oil tankers in the Indian Ocean to be a mix of the serious and the nutty. Quote, some of it was operational, a lot of it was aspirational, and I thought quite a bit of it was delusional.
It's one of the great quotes in the book. I mean, Jim Clapper, who's the director of national intelligence, has been in the business for 4.5 decades. He's a real pro, and I mean, I think that quote speaks for itself. Now, he was able, as a director of national intelligence, you know, to review the, you know, kind of all the documents, and there were some more than 6,000 that were recovered. I was given access to the only to the documents that have been declassified, and in fact, they'll be published on Thursday online for anybody who's interested by West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. And you know, the picture they paint is of a guy who was, you know, blue skying about killing President Obama and General David Petraeus, and you know, those are pretty hard targets. You know, but at the same time, very worried about the drone attacks and telling his people to move out of the Pakistani tribal regions. You know, so it's kind of a mix of, as General Clapper says, delusional, nutty, aspirational, operational. It's kind of a, you know, mix of different kinds of memos. But he had a lot of time on his hands. One of the memos that's in there that is being declassified runs 48 pages and is a very detailed account of, you know, the kind of concerns they had about drones and other issues. Very concerned about Al-Qaeda's name. They were thinking of maybe changing the name because Bin Laden thought that the Obama administration had kind of, well, the brand had been, you know, very much tarnished by Al-Qaeda's behavior in Iraq and other places.
The name of the book is Manhunt, The 10-Year Search for Bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. It is published by Crown. Peter Bergen is the author. I'm interested in what you make of, certainly much of this is election year politics, but the president is coming under some fire for perhaps taking too much credit for the capture and the death of Bin Laden. There was the speech last night that was given. From your vantage point of having covered the story for so long, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, let me answer that in a sort of evidence-based way rather than just saying this is either wrong or right. Let's do the thought experiment where Joe Biden had run the election. Now, he was a Democratic candidate for the presidency, you may recall. If President Biden had been in the Oval Office, that decision would not have happened by his own account. Let's do the thought experiment where President Robert Gates was in office, the defense secretary. He was also against the raid. These are two of the most experienced men in the American national security apparatus. I mean, Joe Biden was elected senator when President Obama was 10. Robert Gates was in the White House when Operation Desert Claw in Iran went south, and you know, the American hostages were not rescued and turned into a total disaster where 8 American servicemen were killed. General James Cartwright, who was the second most senior military officer in the United States at the time, was also advocating a different course than the raid. So to say, you know, the idea that this was sort of an easy call that anybody would have made, that does not hold water. There were very experienced people in the room who were saying you should either wait, you should do a small type of bombing raid on the, use a small experimental bomb from a drone. You know, there were other options being considered. So, you know, it's not clear, it wasn't clear at all to anybody in the final National Security Council meeting what the final decision would be. It was based on circumstantial evidence. You know, Leon Panetta, one of the quotes I have in the book, Leon Panetta and his number two, Mike Morrell, had a discussion an hour before the raid in which they both said to each other, essentially, you know, what do you think? And Morrell says, you know, look, either Bin Laden is going to be there or he isn't. And Leon Panetta replies, that's where I am. So everybody involved in this operation, it's very easy to say, looking back, now we know the outcome, there was no proof that Bin Laden was there. There was just extremely interesting circumstantial evidence. So it's not an easy call. It's not an easy call at all.
Some of the Navy SEALs, in fact, we had a former Navy SEAL from the Team 6 on this morning who said that it was, look, he's a commander-in-chief, and that's what his job is to make those decisions, and you have to respect that. But by the same token, there was some thought that the video that was done with President Clinton was a bit of chest thumping, and regardless of the men who were involved in that actual raid.
Well, you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion about it.
When you look at the legacy of Bin Laden, and you make this point in the book, that okay, we have this enemy number one who's gone, but Al-Qaeda still exists. What is the nature of it, in your opinion? And also, what do you think, did the death of bin Laden change that at all, have an impact on
I think the death of bin Laden amplified and confirmed some big long-term trends for Al-Qaeda that were all going in the wrong direction as far as they were concerned. You know, they were losing the war of ideas in the Muslim world, not because the United States was winning it, certainly, but because they simply lost it. I mean, Muslims around the world were well aware that Al-Qaeda had inflicted a tremendous amount of casualties in Iraq. Even bin Laden, in these documents I reviewed, and people inside Al-Qaeda were very concerned about the activities of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, how counterproductive their attacks on civilians were. So, you know, even before the Arab Spring, in which Al-Qaeda played no meaningful role, even before the death of bin Laden, you know, these guys, this group was not doing well. And the death of their founder and leader is just, you know, is kind of like a very large punctuation mark on a much longer story, which is a story of decline. They haven't done a successful attack in the West since the July 7th, 2005 underground bombings in London. They haven't done any attack in the United States from, you know, since the 9/11 attacks. You know, it's a record of failure, and this group is, you know, the idea that they pose some major strategic threat to the United States is just, it just doesn't hold any water there. These guys are more or less out of business. And, you know, it's very hard for a politician. Last night in President Obama's speech in Afghanistan, you know, he said Al-Qaeda's got big problems. It's very hard for a politician, whether it's President Obama or any other politician, to definitively say these guys are out of business, because, you know, what if you're even 5% wrong or 10% wrong and you have an attack that kills, you know, a couple of dozen people in Manhattan one day? Well, you'd pay a tremendous political cost if you said these guys are completely defeated. The difference with this group is it's never going to be, you know, there's going to be no sort of, you know, ceremony on some aircraft carrier in which they say we are defeated. They're never going to dissolve themselves as the Soviet Union officially did in Russia. That's never going to happen. There will always be, you know, some disaffected young Muslim man somewhere who thinks these are a good set of ideas. But the point is that group of people is smaller and smaller. They're not able to join an effective organization. You know, these groups are under tremendous pressure, not only from the United States, but all of the United States allies.
Backtracking a bit to the decision made by the president and the concerns that there were that bin Laden was actually at this compound, you write in the book that there were anomalies, things that just didn't add up, that there was a dog at the compound where most Muslims don't keep dogs and they consider them to be unclean. There was a child living at the compound who went to a nearby school. So they said, well, you know, wouldn't he say, I got this weird uncle who's living at the at this compound. The proximity to Pakistan's military academy, the families of the courier and his brother that visited family members in other parts of Pakistan. So there were some really big things that were in the minds that said, this isn't the place.
Yeah, you know, you just listed the key anomalies, and you know, so the CIA, there was a very structured process to say, what are the alternative explanations? Let's say, is this another high-value member of Al Qaeda? Is this does the courier now work for a criminal and has left? You know, is he working for somebody? You know, is he no longer part of Al Qaeda but just working for some criminal who's trying to keep a low profile? There were, you know, alternative explorations they try to sort of theorize about what set of explanations could be for this unusual house where people were keeping a low profile. But the best hypothesis was always that bin Laden was there. A so-called red team, came in right at the end of this process with people who hadn't been looking at any of this before. And they also, you know, went through the whole thing. Is this a criminal? Is there somebody else in Al-Qaeda? Is maybe bin Laden's family living there, but he's not living there? And, you know, these were all plausible explanations of the information they had, but the best explanation they had tended to be that bin Laden was there with his family, that the Kuwaiti remained in his part of Al-Qaeda and was protecting him. But, you know, people's certainty about that varied from 40% in one case to 90% in another case. And at the end of the day, assigning a percentage to something which is either true or not true, it's an interesting parlor game, but bin Laden was either there or he wasn't. You know, when you made the decision to go in, you know, you're either going to be 100% wrong or 100% right.
The name of the book is Manhunt, the 10-year search for bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. The book is published by Crown. Peter Bergen, this is incredible work, and I thank you very much for sharing your findings with us and being on the program once again. It's a great pleasure.
I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book is Manhunt, the 10-year search for bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. The book is published by Crown. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.